Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Retronauts Micro. I am your host for this one, Bob Mackey, and who is here with me today?
I'm Henry Gilbert, and I Nintendo.
Oh, wow. Thank you. And who else?
I'm Matt Jay, and I Genesis does.
Wow. So many different verbs happening here. This episode of Retronauts Micro is about your comments on some of my recent episodes. We do mailbags from time to time, but I never have mailbags as part of my normal episodes, and I never actually go back. And I privately read the comments, but I never respond to them in a podcast form. And I decided to do that today because on our Talking Simpsons network that I do with Henry, and Matthew Jay is part of it as well in terms of contributing, we do a show called Talk to the Audience. And that's when we talk about, we respond to questions and comments. It's a lot of fun. I figure, why not do it with you guys without your permission? I'm going to say your name on the air, and you're going to get fired.
That sounds fair.
If you get fired, I owe you a Coke. That always confuses me whenever I hear, I mean, you might have your reasons, but whenever I hear a podcast someone writes in anonymously to talk about, like, I hate Ernest Scared Stupid, what, like, is your job gonna fire you because you wrote into a bad movie podcast,
or like last name withheld?
Yeah It's just, I mean if you're a woman, I understand you always must, yes, keep your identity private on the internet, but I mean, I don't really get it.
The internet is forever. Maybe they're worried about running for Congress someday. Yeah, I mean, brought back up.
It says here that you had a master system as a child. Now, do your parents not love you? How could you run our country?
Oh boy. Like, imagine in, I don't know, 15 years, whoever's running for president, hopefully not Barron Trump, it'll be like, now, I've been looking at your message board post, and it says here you think Vegeta's a gay lord.
Now, as you can clearly see from the footage, he failed to flip this bottle upside down.
Oh, God.
Now, what kind of man could lead a country and not flip a bottle upside perfectly? Look at that dab. He barely commits to that dab.
With the combination of the surveillance state and our need to be famous on the internet at all times, no one can do anything in the future. Any child born after 1998, their life is ruined, right?
Or we all just shrug and say, like, we're all monsters, I guess. Who cares?
Well, that's what it is now everything's our real names, and everything's, yes, tied to you forever. So you need to double down on everything always.
I saw a very funny tweet about this. It was somebody saying, like, hey, isn't that, it was people at a party, and it was, then word balloons were put in, and somebody says, like, hey, isn't that guy like a known harasser? And they're like, yeah, but he deleted his Facebook and moved two towns over. So what are you going to do?
It's like crossing state lines in an old movie. You just restart your life, like a grifter in an old movie. You just restart your life, new identity, new grift. That's how it works.
Make him a new name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Works for some people.
To slide into.
So that being said, we're going to slander some of you and ruin your potential for future jobs, starting with actually a Talking Simpsons friend, Zachary Adams, a president of the United States. And he says, so these are all comments about our history of video game ads, part 1 and 2. And I believe Henry and Matthew were both on this episode.
Yeah.
I loved it. We're going to do more of these in the future. There's still like 15 years more of ads to cover. But
I think you stopped before I was born.
I did. We stopped.
It was right after I was born.
Right at, like, in the 16-bit console wars is where we stopped. Yeah. So we still have like Sony to cover and the Xbox and things like that.
But
Sonic,
I don't know if I'm Red E for that.
The Red E and Polygon Man, all that stuff. But let's get to Zachary Adams' comment. And he says, this was pretty great. It missed my childhood favorite 5200 Hello Judy ad. Probably because it was terrible, but when I was 6, a pause button for a video game seemed revolutionary. And I looked up a few of these ads. We're going to play them on the show. And here is the Hello Judy ad for the Atari 5200.
This is an arcade game. This is the new Atari Super System. Arcade? Atari Super System. You may like the Super System better. It has some of the best arcade and sports games and plays every Atari cartridge. It even does something no arcade game can.
Telephone! It's Judy!
It lets you freeze the action.
Hello, Judy.
The new 5200 Super System.
I needed to go back to, I want to hear that reading of Hello, Judy again.
It was bad.
You guys talked over that brilliant piece of dialogue.
Hello, Judy.
Man.
The new 5200.
Open the door for your mystery date. Who wants to talk to that guy?
Hello, Judy.
I'm going to hurt her.
You remind me of Miss Pac-Man.
Judy, can you help me get this mattress in the back of my car?
Oh, boy. So that is the revolutionary pause feature. So who wants to take another Zachary?
That is pretty amazing, the idea that it would be novel that you could pause a game. You can't do that in the arcade.
Yeah, no more tactical gaming diapers for you. You can just pause and pee and poop of your own free will.
Zachary Walton says, I wonder if he's related to the Walmart Waltons.
Or the famous Walton families.
He should be giving you more money if he is.
Yeah, I agree. Let's step it up here. You guys have a castle.
He says, to the gender question, I think one anecdote is that video games were placed in the electronics section pre-crash, and that section of the store is non-gendered. Post-crash, Nintendo marketed the NES as a toy, and stores had to place the system in the toy section, which is very gendered. The stores chose to place it in the boy section, and the marketing followed. Video games eventually found their way back to the electronics section, but the damage had already been done.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that aspect of it, the very gendered toy selling, as we all remember from the now dead Toys R Us. It was like, there's the pink aisle, and then there's all the other aisles that are boys. And the video games and all the Toys R Us's I went to as a kid were like almost the opposite side of the store.
Same
from the
here.
Barbie aisle.
It was like board games and then video games. Mm-hmm. I feel that I agree with like 80% of this, but I feel like perhaps even today, electronics and games and stuff, they were always sort of implicitly gendered, even before the distinction from the pink aisle to the video game aisle. I feel like, oh no, these are for boys. Boys will play with these things. And anyways, but
and like the electronics section of a Target or even like the entirety of a Best Buy is like the man cave store.
Yeah, yeah.
It looks like the sad store. Even there's like giant leather. There's a whole section of Best Buy still that's like, well, you could use this space for anything. And it's just like 10 Barker loungers in front of the biggest TV
Jesus,
in the world.
I know. But no, I totally agree with the one point where it's like they're explicitly gendered. There was a game section in which the NES was sold with a gun, like a toy gun.
Yep.
So
and a Rob, not a Roberta.
Yeah, and a robot. A gun and a robot, both boy toys.
It's
so,
Adam and Rob.
Yeah, not Mario and Stevie. Who knows? I fucked that up. Let's move on to Henry.
David says, Sega Master System ads were awesome. One of them starts Steven Dorff.
And we'll play the first one out of this reel. I don't know if Steven Dorff is in it. I can't really tell, but it's we didn't actually play any Master System ads on the any of these podcasts we did. So let's hear one of them.
Sega challenges you with the ultimate video game. The Sega Master System, with twice as much memory as any other video game. Advanced video technology like scrolling backgrounds, graphics in 64 colors, digital sounds, and light phasers. And you can add to the excitement with sports pads, control sticks, and the first video games ever in 3D.
Sega's the one.
The Sega Master System. The challenge will always be there.
So yes, we didn't actually play any Master System ads on these podcasts, but that's pretty like high budget for a failure.
As a child, I don't remember ever seeing a Master System ad. They weren't advertising in a way I saw it. The only time when I realized a Master System existed, it was before Sonic came out, but I saw it at a like Sears, just walking around to Sears and seeing like, hey, that's a Nintendo. Oh, is this a different Nintendo?
It's from Canada, I think.
As a 7-year-old, that's all I knew to understand it. Yeah. Like, Nintendo is the game machine. That's how it was to me.
I mean, they had that Tonka money to throw around in terms of advertising because it was distributed by Tonka. So I feel like maybe that's why they actually had some sort of footprint that I never saw.
The CG logo at the end is impressive. I'm not familiar with that tagline at all. The
Sega's the one.
Will always be what do they say?
The challenge will always be there.
That's
the
dumb.
The challenge. Yeah, that's a bad tagline. Boo. No wonder you failed.
So I'm up next here. I'm going to say it's either Nick Fugate or Nick Fugate says.
I think it's Fugate.
Fugate?
Like Temple Fugate, the clock king?
You let us know, Nick, how we mangled your name, but he says, surprise, we didn't get William Shatner in the Commodore VIC 20 commercials. And he's here. He beams in. And he's all pudgy in his TJ Hooker kind of getup.
He's even got his TJ Hooker wig on, it looks like.
Yeah. So here it is. And actually, he's appearing in a commercial in which they're doing a parody of the Intellivision commercials. So there's a parody of George Plimpton. It's a very good impression. And it's a parody of that little wiener kid he's with.
Wow.
So let's That's hear awesome. It.
When it comes to video games, nobody compares to Atari.
I find Intellivision more sophisticated and lifelike. Gentlemen, move over for my friend Vic, the Commodore VIC 20.
Move over.
The Commodore VIC 20 does more than your machines. It's a great computer that also plays great games, like this, and this, and this.
A computer that plays great games?
What? $300?
Exactly.
We didn't know.
Get the Commodore VIC 20 computer for under...
So there you have it. That was William Shatner for the VIC-20.
They even have him non-trademark breaking beam in.
Yeah, yeah. That with a bad video effect.
God, that was hilarious just because it reminded me of, do you recall when Windows was launching Windows 10, I think it was, and they hired a John Hodgman lookalike to be there.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I'm a PC, and I also do this. And it was so weird. But it's the same style as this commercial here.
Man, those PC and Mac commercials, I hated them because they were smug and irritating, mm-hmm. but also because it's like, you're trying to get me to hate John Hodgman? Yeah. Like, you want me to think Justin Long is a better person and cooler?
Yeah. I am a Justin Long defender. I feel like he got screwed over by a lot of stuff, but like, yeah, he's no John Hodgman.
Yeah, come on.
Those ads did a lot to ruin Apple's reputation for like a decade, which sucks.
I thought it helped them because they were wildly popular.
Yeah, but I still feel like Windows Defender. Yeah, maybe those people held no real sway, but like they were a big like, well, Apple's got those shitty ads, you know, in the Apple's versus PC.
It's a real
debate.
Smugness to them. I don't like retrospect, I don't like them. I do like that John Hodgman got to make lots of money and get more famous.
I like when they was it before the iPod commercials with the people dancing?
No, that was first.
Okay.
Yeah,
I like that
ones
more.
Were first.
That was cool, the rotoscoping effect on those.
Those were cool, yeah.
I'm going to throw this Mac in the garbage now.
So up next, I guess, Matthew.
This is from the Nintendo GameCube episode.
Yeah, you were on that one. Henry was not. I think he refused to be on it. And,
I wasn't on this episode.
I actually...
Oh, that's right.
I was on the PS2 episode.
It was Cat Bailey and I think Dave Rudd.
Yes, I am very bummed I wasn't on this one, actually. I am a huge GameCube fan.
I want to apologize to Bob here live on
You know what? As a podcast host, what I like to hear from everybody... Yes. Is we did an episode about this. You didn't invite me.
Every episode of Retro Nauts you have on 40 guests so all your friends can not be forgotten.
Yeah, this is why I don't have friends.
I unironically did that to Bob. I didn't know I was doing it, and I just said, you know, I don't want to be that guy who says you did a Rodma podcast without me.
If you wanted to fly to the wintry hell of Wisconsin where I was stuck for 3 days, you could have been my guest.
All I'm saying is I was a child when the GameCube was out, and it was made for children. So.
Yeah, you and your tiny hands.
But I do. I'm a big, big fan of the GameCube. I'm still a fan of the GameCube controller. Not as much, but...
We'll talk about it. There's some differences of opinion about the controller.
Guillermo Jimenez said, I remember hearing back in 2001 that Nintendo didn't want the GameCube to be abbreviated NGC because they didn't want it confused with Neo Geo Pocket Color. That makes more sense than the National Geographic Channel thing, but the weird thing is that they still went with NGC in Japan. Yeah, it's GCN here, right?
Yeah, GameCube Nintendo.
One of the biggest Nintendo fan magazines in Mexico changed its name from N64 to NGC in 2001 and then actually changed it to GCN in early 2002.
Oh.
Coincidentally, after a reader pointed out in a rival magazine that Nintendo had changed the abbreviation. That's funny.
Yeah, we pointed out on the show that it kind of baffled me that the abbreviation was GCN.
Me too. I always thought it was weird, and I was not aware of the Neo Geo Pocket Color until much later, although now I am a massive fan of that console. I sold mine right before the price skyrocketed. I sold it to move, and I was super bummed that I was like, I'll sell it, and then a few months later, I'll buy another one. They're dirt cheap. I sold it in box with the Sonic pack in, which is a great secret best 2D Sonic game, is Sonic Pocket Adventure. And now they're like hundreds of dollars.
That's
it's crazy.
Weird. Whenever I go to a lot of retro gaming cons, because we do that for Retronauts, and the cheapest thing you can buy there outside of PSP movies are just like bucketfuls of Neo Geo Pocket Color games.
The games are super cheap. I don't know if they still that cheap? That's cool.
They're like just... steal them, no one cares.
Certain ones are like hundreds of dollars, but most of them are very cheap because they made a ton of them, and they also would only print one of them a lot of the time, and they would just have it in it. Both languages would be in it, and you change
your
console settings to switch it, so it detected what your console setting was.
My favorite thing with Neo Geo Pocket Color is the sound of the D-pad. Well, not
little
D-pad.
Clicky stick.
Just click, click, click. Yeah,
just the clickety-click. So satisfying.
That was my first fidget cube. I would have that in my pocket and just click it around.
I forget which came first, but my friends got a Neo Geo Pocket Color, and I was just like, oh, this looks cool. And then like the Game Boy Advance came out like a week later, and I'm like, well, this is what you want.
It stomped its stick in the dirt. Because first it was the Neo Geo Pocket, which was then the Game Boy Color destroyed it. They might have been might have been the Game Boy Color first, I forget. But then the Neo Geo Pocket Color, so they're catching up to that. And then, yeah, the GBA is like, it's the Super Nintendo in your pocket. And it's like, oh, crap.
Yeah, that's what I wanted.
But the games on the Pocket, so a lot of times when that happens, you're like, oh, well, this console's just obsolete. But the games in the Neo Geo Pocket Color are so specifically made for it and are such specific games that I still feel like nothing has touched it. Like portable fighting games.
Yeah, those are really good.
Never been as good, especially because of the stick. That stick made it so satisfying to play. Like, Gal's Fighter should be on everyone's top 10 fighting games of all time. That's how good that game is.
Yeah, but I mean, everyone eventually, every company has to learn you can't make a portable system. You will be destroyed. Yeah. Like, Sony tried twice, and with the Vita, they were even less successful than the PSP. The PSP had like 18 hot months in America, as we learned on that podcast.
And Monster Hunter made it real popular in Japan.
Oh, yeah.
Well, this Neo Geo Pocket Color thing reminded me of the upcoming Switch game I'm really looking forward to, Pocket Rumble.
Comes out the day of this recording.
What?
What is that again?
Whoa. It is a Neo Geo Pocket Color style fighting game that is a two-button command, very intentionally simple. Like, I've just never seen... I've seen indie games that ape a lot of retro styles, but not Neo Geo Pocket.
It's such a specific style. It's never... Yeah, it's never been done that well, and that it's... They had to rethink the way they drew sprites and design games to fit this specific console. GBA, it was just like, we made games smaller, which is great. That's a great way to make games. The PSP, we made games smaller. The DS, we made games smaller with a touchscreen. That's always what their goal is. But the Neo Geo Pocket Color, they were like, no, this is its own jam. Check it. It's
I'm downloading this on Switch today. But this has nothing to do with the game.
Yeah. What the hell are you guys doing?
A competitor.
Another big game for the Neo Geo Pocket Color is the Card Fighters Clash game, everyone wants a sequel to that, and they got one for the DS, but it was horrible for whatever reason.
It came with a game breaking bug if you bought it in its first printing.
So like remake that in some way. I think everyone wants that. But
I will say one thing: it is very tied to the GameCube because they beat the GameCube to something, which is a very underrated part of the GameCube, which is its connectivity to the GBA.
Oh, yeah,
that's right.
As we mentioned in the Wind Waker episode, I felt like, before I found out you guys did, because you're also weirdos, I felt like I was the only person to ever play the multiplayer in Wind Waker. But the GB or the Neo Geo Pocket Color connected to the Dreamcast, which I'm also a weirdo. That's my favorite. That's my favorite console.
That's
of an all time.
That's like unholy.
Yeah, like, and it's also like there's SNK and Sega. Like, they're so unrelated in so many ways. I own a... do I still own it? I have a link cable for the Neo Geo Pocket Color. So it's like, I have this thing made for no one.
That works with what, like one game?
I might have sold
game?
It, I forget. But I got it for like $5 and sold it for like 50.
But we have a burning pony question here.
Yes. Penelope the Wonder Pony says, I still maintain that the GameCube had the best button layout of any controller. The big, chunky A button was just so satisfying to mash on. Games like Rogue Leader just wouldn't feel so good without it. And the distinctive shape of each button made it very easy to introduce new people to the to the console. You could easily tell from on-screen icons which button you need without having to stare down at the controller and remind yourself which one was A and which one was B.
I could see that.
I super agree with this.
I love the GameCube controller so much. I'll play Smash Brothers other ways, but it only feels right to me in a GameCube controller.
Did you buy that Switch thing?
Especially that the C-Stick. Like, the C-Stick for Smash is...
So that's the thing. I think the C-Stick is the real what hampered it to being a competitor to the other controllers.
It's not good as a second analog stick.
That's exactly right. It's missing... It's just like the Dreamcast. It's missing a second analog stick, which would make it hold up to time much better.
No,
But the whole, like the idea that it's just a different button layout is because every game console is just four buttons now, and the Switch, we've been constantly regressing since this, where the Switch doesn't even have a D-pad, a Nintendo console with a shitty D-pad. What crazy future are we living in?
On the episode, we complained about the GameCube controller and that it was like it was too complex for if you showed it to someone who hadn't played games for a while, they'd be like, what the hell do I do with this? I feel like it. I don't know if I said this on the show itself, but I feel like it is good for games designed for that controller, but things that were ported to the GameCube had a real problem making that feel elegant in any way.
Yeah, and its candy-colored buttons is a turnoff to grown-up games men who want to play games for men. I almost feel like Nintendo reacted in the opposite direction, not with... so they made the Wii Remote, which couldn't be more different from the GameCube controller. But then... on every generation, the Wii, Wii U, and Switch, where they make the regular controller, it is the most boring looking nothing. It almost looks like third party. They're like, oh, you want a boring ass controller? Here's the most boring one. Pff, fucking play Skyrim on it.
When we went to New York before the Switch came out to see the unveiling of it, mm-hmm. and we played it for the first time, I was incredibly wrong about the Switch. I thought it would be a horrible failure because the gimmick to me was just like, yeah, you've made portable consoles before. Who cares? Like, people have played Game Boy and 3DSs. They know what it's like to take a game on the road with them. Mm-hmm. But the main stumbling block for me in terms of like, will this catch on or not, was the Switch controllers have like 40,000 buttons. There are like hidden buttons you can discover on there, buttons I forget exist.
There's a camera in it.
Yeah, it's like, who, like what are people going to do with this? But I guess they got over that because it's a huge success. So yeah. I was wrong, everybody.
But that's the thing. And then when you complain about it, someone's like, why don't you just get the classic controller, whatever it's called? And it's like, hey, I don't put this on my TV, you gross weirdo.
I never
play this.
I only undocked when I went to Japan. I'm still ashamed of it. Listen, you start playing video games to never leave your couch. That's what it's for.
I never leave my bed. I want to play it.
Yeah. No, my TV, I want to have the Office reruns on while I'm playing my game in my lap.
So I think, am I up next?
Yes.
Okay, so Guts Sant says...
Guts Van Sant.
I take issue with some comments about the GameCube controller because I personally love it and I like it more than the PS2 and PS3 DualShocks.
Whoa, I don't know.
Particularly because my original GameCube controllers are still working perfectly while the Sony ones have had to be replaced or scrapped. Mm-hmm. Repaired or scrapped. I, in particular, dislike the analog of almost all other consoles when compared to the GameCube ones, which feel just perfect, and they still work great to play despite heavy Smash usage. Mm. The D-pad has never been an issue for me. Well, you know what, Gus Sant? This is the largest game controller I can afford. A lot of people wrote in like, you Retronauts have freakishly huge hands. It's like, yes, like, I don't play basketball or anything, but that controller is so, like, so I will say, in terms of the quality of the build, it is a solid-ass controller. Like, it feels so, like, perfect and just, like really just well-built. But I say the D-pad is like, I need to get in there with like a child thumb to hit those buttons because
not the best D-pad.
It like your my thumb covers the entire D-pad. It just consumes it.
Did you own a Wavebird?
Yes, and that's actually the one Nintendo controller that I've owned that stopped working. Was
Wavebird. Really?
Yeah, I had to buy another one.
Mine never broke. Though actually GameCube was very. The GameCube controller, mine were pretty durable, except I did, maybe from playing too much Smash on it, but I wore out the thumbstick. Like, the plastic part started falling off, and I had to buy a new one.
One of my friends did that, and I would get the second player controller, mm-hmm. which didn't have the pad on it. It was just like a spiky plastic thing, and I'm like, well, I'm just going to destroy my thumb here. Although it's not a great D-pad, but to again bring up the Dreamcast, have you ever like played a fighting game on the Dreamcast with the D-pad?
The Dreamcast has a terrible controller.
It's like a cheese grater.
I can hear the comments coming in, but that thing is all kinds of fucked up. The cord's coming out of the wrong end. The D-pad just cuts you up.
I love the controller, except missing another stick and the D-pad. But I love the look of it. I love it. It looks like a little spaceship. Everything about it.
The weight of it always felt wrong to me when there wasn't a VMU in it. So that's also true. Just felt too flimsy.
And you have to hold your hands like at a perfect like parallel angle to each other, like in the most unnatural way. Like who, like what monster tested this?
But I remember my friend and I, when I lived in Connecticut, my roommate and I were playing through rival schools, and we were like, we would get to the final boss and just have to keep switching off every round because we're like, I'm like, dude, my thumb is killing me. Like, it's red. Look at it.
Yeah, gross. So we're moving on to the Doom episode, which neither of you were on. Jeff Green was on it and Michael Raparez, but Kyle Overby is talking about the BFG, and we'll get a bit more into that after the comment is over. I have a blog post to tell you about.
Kyle Overby says, I only read up on how the BFG works after I actually played John Romero in a Doom 2 tournament back in the early 2000s at a Dallas area gaming tournament, which he attended as a guest. Whoa, dude. I advanced through a few rounds with a primary strategy of using double-barreled shotgun at close range, but when I played John, he pretty much exclusively used the BFG and outscored me by a factor of 4 or 5. His strategy was to get the BFG, then find a corner where two hallways intersected. He would then look down the hallway to see where I was coming towards him, shoot the corner near him with the BFG, and then I would die with the projectile having hit nowhere close to me. Turns out, as outlined in the Steam post, the BFG calculates most of the damage done via hit scan at the moment when the projectile hits, but emanates from the player in the direction the projectile was fired. I'm not following that at all. So he shot at the corner with just enough of a lead time that he could strafe into a hall and then get me in the cone when the projectile exploded next to him on the corner. I don't know if how the BFG worked was as widely understood then, though this was after the release of the Doom source code, but John certainly knew how it worked, winky face. He was very nice in person, taking the time to talk with me and shake hands afterwards.
Ah, John Romero, so sweet.
Holy crap.
Yes, so Kyle is referencing a like 5,000 word Steam message board post that goes into like extremely granular detail about how the BFG functions as a weapon within the rules of the game, and I'll link to that on the blog post for this episode. But it's too kind of boring to get into here. I mean, it's super interesting, but if we talked about it, you would not be super interested.
Is
so.
That true in all Doom games or just Doom 2?
I believe I'm sure in Doom 1 and 2 they are very similar, mm-hmm. or perhaps identical.
Same code.
Yeah,
copy and paste.
But I believe it is just in this context just Doom 2. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a man after my own name, Hardcore Henry.
That's my nickname for Henry,
says,
by the way.
but not because of the movie.
If I were forced to choose just one video game franchise, Doom is probably my favorite of all time, although almost certainly not, quote, the best, but every vast contribution / influence made to the FPS genre has long since been completely subsumed into the pop culture ether, and arguably had already been by the time the disappointing third entry was finally released. That errant signal guy waxes poetic about what a personality-revealing labor of love the first two games, 64, Master Levels, Brutal, and all the other countless mods, etc., were. And I definitely agree. But I think he glosses over what an incredible role luck and timing played in all of this. Released 3 to 4 years earlier, and the pixels couldn't contain enough detail to do the hell theme justice. Wolfenstein had a far less ambitious aesthetic only a couple years earlier, and the graphics barely passed muster. Released 3 or 4 years later, and is there any doubt that it wouldn't be an early polygon title? With the horror, the horror. The same goes for the rise of PC gaming. No way would this series have had the same impact without the expansions, beating the ESRB to the punch, being a part of the last generation of A games to be built without a huge impersonal team, etc. Better to be lucky than good.
Yeah, to use a cliche, it was really lightning in a bottle for Doom, and we talked about it on the show that it somehow avoided, at the time it was released, it somehow avoided the whole violence outrage issue because it was released for computers, and presumably a child could not just go out and buy a computer because they were thousands of dollars. You had to be an adult with an adult paycheck, and then you were the gatekeeper to whoever played those games.
Lieberman wasn't worried about little Johnny or Sally playing
that. He was
that.
Worried about a like neon blue covered gun ruining a child's life in Lethal Enforcers.
Yeah, my dad was telling me that like in the early 90s he bought his first computer. It was like 1990. It was like $2,500.
Yeah, yeah.
In that time's money.
I remember like on an old, so we talk a lot about Mystery Science Theater on this network and all of our networks, but I used to have like a ton of old VHS tapes, like from the Sci-Fi Channel era, from the Comedy Central era, but like even in the mid 90s, you'd see an ad for like, I don't know, like a Dell PC, just $2,800. It's like, holy Christ, this was 20 years ago.
Nowadays, that would be like the hottest gaming PC you could possibly
yes,
build.
There'd be like flames coming out of it.
Yeah, it'd be all green and glow.
But I think someone on one of the comments, someone pointed out that so when Columbine happened, they're like, the government was like, well, who can we blame? It's not our fault. Video games. And there's a great picture, you can find it online. It's like a Getty Images of Senator Orrin Hatch, the Honorable Orrin Hatch from Utah, holding a copy of Doom 2, like with the very ends of his fingers and thumbs, as if the demons on the box could hurt him in some way.
Or like it's dirty.
Yeah, it's like, ooh, get this away from me. Our television games episode was great. It was about video games based on TV shows that weren't cartoons. We got a lot of fun mileage out of that. Mm. And most of these responses, actually all of them, are based on Alf. We talked to an Alf writer recently on Talking Simpsons. Yeah. We'll tell you more about that with the second response. So Muteki says, Alf for the Master System really gets you thinking about what a masterclass in game design the infamous Takeshi Challenge really is in comparison, especially because of how similar the starting area music is. Yes, and I want to say, Muteki, it is a stunning coincidence that that game bears any resemblance to a game that was intentionally trolling people. This was just people making a 20-minute game. They needed to make it more than a 20-minute experience, so they found ways to screw you over at every turn, which is what so many games were of this era. But I do appreciate, on some level, how Alf just will fuck you over. Like, we talk about in this episode where you earn money in the game. I believe there's a finite amount of money in the game. And you just go to a store and one of the items is a book. You buy the book and it ends the game. It just is like, and then the game ended, the end or whatever. There are traps designed in this to just screw you over at every turn. And
does Alf do karaoke?
Alf does not do karaoke.
Through the controller?
And he should. There are not enough Alf-like, you have a cat as an item at one point.
Alf's not very funny. It kind of misses the whole, unlike now, I mean, in the game, Alf isn't very funny. Alf's funny. Okay. Alf is hilarious. Bob, you had the Alf hand puppet.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
With, I think it was Hardee's, was it?
Burger King, I believe.
Burger King, yeah.
Whoa.
You got to act out all your fun Alf things with you. You got to have your own Alf puppet. Though really, it wasn't a full-size puppet. It was just one that fit over just your hand.
Now you can say what we're all thinking, just like Alf. So we have another comment. Before Matthew reads this, though, I want to say that we did talk to Mike Reese. So Mike Reese was a writer from The Simpsons, a writer on The Simpsons from the first season until the current season. He took about 2 years off to just, hang out. But before The Simpsons, he wrote for Alf. He joined in the second season, and we talked to him about that on our Patreon-exclusive interview with him at patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons.
It's a great interview. I listened to
it. Oh, thank you. He's a hilarious, nice guy, and he said, like, Alf was the nicest, most pleasant show he's ever written for, because they just would leave and go home at 6 o'clock instead of staying up until 2 to write a sign gag, like on The Simpsons.
Well, because he said that a ton of writers quit the first season, so when they hired the second season writers, they're like, everybody goes home at 6. This is going to be a happy work-life balance.
Yeah, and despite all of the negative things I've heard about Paul Fusco, the voice of Alf and also the creator of the show, he did not say anything negative about him. I believe Al Jean, Mike Reese's former writing partner, is the guy who is not an Alf fan.
Isn't Al Jean also the one who, in his years of after returning to The Simpsons, he instated the same rule of, you know what, we're not here till 2 a.m. anymore. It's 9 to 5, and you go home, and people often, or is it the other guy?
I think it was Mike Scully.
Is that Mike Scully? Okay. People often consider that to be the decision that killed The Simpsons.
Well, I mean,
which I don't know.
Mike Scully was in his 40s when he took over the show, and the previous showrunners were in their late 20s and had no children and no lives outside of running a TV show. So they had different priorities.
Mm-hmm. I also want to mention, this ruined your momentum there, but you talked about having how, like, the puppets you would get based on Alf are, like, not the same puppet. That's also true of the Muppets. They're also, like, very simple puppets. I wonder if there's, like, a rule that, like, we can't just sell a Kermit puppet, because then they just make internet memes with it, well, and people think it's real.
I would bet it, at least when Jim Henson was alive, he probably wanted to tell kids, like, no, that would be like you own Kermit. You can't own Kermit. We control Kermit.
But also, Alf is a huge-ass puppet. It's like it's like sort of like a Telly the Monster-style puppet, where it's like two people's arms are in it, and one person's working the mouth.
One hand's in a mouth, one hand's in an arm.
And you never want to see Alf's lower half. It's disgusting.
Oh,
it's
God,
bad.
You don't.
It's wrong.
No.
So
he's nude, always.
Joe Blow is writing in. I believe this is a peek into the darker first season of Alf.
Okay, so Joe Blow says, so there was at least two people who were smoking crack and or doing heroin who worked on Alf at its time. Yes, I know where this is going. One of the writers of the show was Jerry Stahl, who did that autobiography Permanent Midnight, which was made into a movie with fucking Ben Stiller, which was about him being really addicted to sorts of hard drugs while writing for TV shows in Hollywood while making a good living doing it. It's gotten comparisons to Requiem for a Dream, but it's more like Basketball Diaries, except it's really bad.
I wouldn't say really bad.
You've seen it?
But I did watch it because I was on a real Stiller kick then. It was before it's pre Meet the Parents Stiller, so it's
I'm
less
a Stiller
famous.
Defender.
It's got Liz Hurley in it as well. She plays his wife. And though the funniest bit in it, The trailers did lie to me because I thought it was a comedic film, which it really isn't. It's him trying to get an Oscar, and he failed. But at the start of the movie, or one scene in the movie, he's on a talk show, and on the fake talk show is another person who's dealt with drugs, and it is played by Andy Dick, and
he's being
very silly. And I was like, oh, this is so funny. Ben Stiller and Andy Dick together again, making fun of drugs.
Wow.
Stiller also comes from TV writing stock. That's a world he was familiar with from his upbringing because of his parents.
But in the movie, if you want to see a film where Jerry Stahl writes an episode of ALF based on his mother's irreconcilable grief at his father's passing, you'll see that
holy,
in the movie.
Holy hell.
Is he literally playing him? Do they write ALF in the show, or is it like a fake show?
He's a green ALF, not called ALF, but even I didn't know what Jerry Stahl's background was, and when I saw the movie, I was like, oh, he wrote for ALF. Mm-hmm. And also in the movie, if you want to see Ben Stiller pretend to shoot heroin into his neck while a baby sits in the car with him, you'll also see that.
That's your Oscar moment, right?
Yeah, that sounds like a movie.
He thought it was.
So up next, we have Spider-Man Games. So this is an episode that Henry was on, and Henry helped like build this episode because I know nothing of Spider-Man or his universe. So
Phil Spider-Man.
Please check this first comment out.
Yes,
Henry.
Or another Zach says, the crazy thing is Paragon didn't just get lucky. They had a rep for doing licensed games, mostly off tabletop RPGs like Mega Traveler and Space 1889. And they were distributed by MicroProse, which gave them more oomph. Most of their work holds up poorly. CRPG Addict has replayed several, and it ain't pretty. But within the weird niche of pre-Windows 95 gaming, they were perceived at the time as a reasonable second-tier studio. I just bought both X-Men Madness and Murder World and Doctor Doom's Revenge well after their release. The thing that struck me about most of them was the one-on-one fighting mode both games shared. And it's like someone was trying to figure out how to make Children of the Atom in a world where Karate Champ was the only frame of reference. Map the controls to a keyboard with no mouse or joystick, and then graft it into a very different game. That sounds bonkers.
Which ones were the Paragon ones? Actually, I'm looking at it now. It's the one where Spider-Man turns into Spider Skeleton when he gets hurt.
Yes. Yeah. It wasn't the... It was the one with Captain America in it as well. It wasn't the Spider-Man climb command ones. It was a little after that. It's sort of a platformer. It really wants to be, but those were the ones we were talking about so you have character sprites that I guess technically you could, I didn't know those had a fighting game part to it, but I guess if you have sprites, you can make them move in a fighting game style, even if you don't know how to make a fighting game.
I like the subtitle Madness and Murder World.
That's Arcade's.
Where Arcade, the villain Arcade, not an arcade.
I want to ask, speaking of X-Men fighting, because you mentioned Children of the Atom and also the GameCube, did you guys play X-Men Mutant Academy 1 or 2?
No, never.
Those look like dog shit. I did not buy them.
They were
bad.
All right. They were kind of in the vein.
It was them trying to make Tekken, right?
Yes. It was like Tekken, but it moved around a bit more. It made me think of Bloody Roar at the time, because that was another popular GameCube fighting game. But they had a lot of silly things in them that I miss in comic book fighting games, or comic book games in general, like the What If mode in Spider-Man games. But they had like Spider-Man's in X-Men Mutant Academy 2, so Spider-Man's unlockable character. That's cool. And they, you could fight at the pool. You could unlock the pool as a thing, and when you fought there, everyone had a secret bathing suit costume, including Spider-Man, who just had short sleeves and shorts, which was cool. And you could also play as Professor X.
My favorite X-Men game is the one that made Dennis Dyack lose all of his credibility.
Yeah, that was good.
I made fun of him on YouTube for that one.
Awesome.
On his video where he called you out.
I miss the pre-millennium Marvel games and DC games too, because you had people making decisions who weren't afraid of billionaires. Like, they're just like, sure, Punisher, put him in there. You license something. Just put, oh, you made a funny thing? Put Spider-Man in that.
Yeah, they were all just Marvel characters.
Now, to get, just imagine, even some company as big as Activision just telling Marvel, hey, we made that Spider-Man game. Can we just put him in our skating game too? Marvel would just go like, no, that's not part of this 800-page licensing agreement.
We did not hire 800 brand managers for you to do that, sir.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you ever in the... I don't know if you covered this in the episode, but in the first Spider-Man PS1 game, if you did it just right, you could swing to the Fantastic Four Tower?
See, that is not in the... We stopped in 1996, okay. Web of Fire, just to save the 3D ones for...
Yeah, there are so many Spider-Man
games.
Well,
if you do it right...
It was already too long.
Yeah, it's like 2 hours.
If you do it right, you can swing to the Fantastic Four building.
The Baxter building.
And the Human Torch is hanging on top of it. And you talk to him. It's a little cutscene.
Wow.
That's awesome.
But also, last thing I'll say about X-Men Mutant Academy is you can play as Professor X, who also has a bathing suit. Mm-hmm. And when you hit up to jump, he just does a wheelie.
Oh.
He doesn't leave the ground.
I don't know if that's offensive or not. But
I don't know. I mean...
Let's move on to Blarg, who is correcting Henry, notorious liar on podcasts. So Blarg says, slight correction. Henry says Venom first appeared in Marvel vs. Capcom 2. He actually was in the first Marvel vs. Capcom. Even though Marvel went through a bankruptcy in 1996, Marvel characters still appeared in Marvel vs. Street Fighter 97 and Marvel vs. Capcom 1998. Maybe Capcom had a pre-existing deal with them or something. Well, I mean, just because a company has a bankruptcy doesn't mean they go away or their licenses go away.
They could have made that deal before bankruptcy, and maybe they just let the Spider-Man one go fallow, the solo Spider-Man one, as opposed to the overall deal they had with Capcom.
Mm-hmm.
Also, perhaps they made a deal with Marvel's Japan branch that then was like... accidentally Universal, and so they could make a deal with people who weren't going through bankruptcy.
Sometimes you can go bankrupt multiple times and then be president.
It happens, yeah.
It's possible.
So we talked on this episode, the Spider-Man episode, I believe, about Stan Lee. There's an infamous clip online. The one that's uploaded that I watched is from the great YouTuber H Bomber Guy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's basically Stan Lee in the early 90s. He got up on the wrong side of the bed, and he's very angry at Rob Liefeld. And who else is in this
Todd
clip?
Todd McFarlane.
Todd McFarlane, really? Okay. So I want to play a bit of this clip. And in this clip, they are drawing overt kill. Is it overt kill?
Oh, he's overkill. So Stanley tells them, I have a character name, Overkill, which he's making fun of them by telling them to do a thing called Overkill.
Okay.
But overkill. Then later in Spawn, when Todd McFarlane just wants to use the character again, he legally calls him Overt Kill.
Yes.
To make
Thank
him
you.
So different.
Todd McFarlane, you dumb dipshit.
So I put this clip up in a really good point where he starts ripping into the drawing of this character. We'll play a lot of it. I just love I want to say that this is a dumb character and these guys are kind of in over their heads, but I feel like he's being too mean, but I think it's also hilarious.
Let me give another bit of context.
Okay.
At this point, Stan Lee is not doing well. He's
he's
getting a little bit of money from Marvel because this is when it still says Stan Lee Presents on all the comic
books.
Right. And Todd McFarlane and Rob Liefeld are millionaires.
They're taking off. I also have thoughts on this, but I want to play the clip.
It's great. We can pause at any moment to add in our thoughts too.
He's got the biggest shoulder pads ever existed. It's like
I figured he would.
Chest.
Okay, I'm gonna give him some big knee pads here, because a guy like him that's got some armor and got some guns and
Has
stuff like that
pads.
Is gonna.
Boy, he looks grim, doesn't he?
Kids, you know, I mean, the kids like the dark, moody stuff. I mean,
they seem
you know,
to.
The, yeah. I mean, you're...
But I have a question I've been wanting to ask you guys. Mm-hmm. How long does it take these people to get dressed? These kind of characters.
Who says they undress?
I mean, there's something they have to get out quickly to save the world, but it takes them an hour and a half to get into all of this stuff
that's
if
right.
they work fast.
That's right. Getting into the costume is like going to the bathroom in comic book. You never show it, but you assume that Superman and Batman and Spider-Man actually do go and urinate every now and then,
right? You're
right,
but you never do show it, do you?
No.
But you do show, very often you show people getting dressed, especially women. I seem to recall that now.
I fucking love that. One, that Todd McFarlane thinks he's got a gotcha on Stan. Like, well, look, you don't show it all the time. Yeah, that's right, Todd. Superman has never been shown getting into costume. That's never happened in a Superman comic.
In a phone booth.
And then also, Stan just like really sticking it to him, like, oh, you show women dressing quite a lot.
Man, he's done his research. Let's hear more of this. I love it. Sorry.
Being woke.
Are you into hens, really?
Oh, yeah, I'm the best.
You do hens?
Okay, then why don't we give them here... wires coming out here, coming down. Up.
They
the
love
kids,
that
The kids
stuff.
Love wires.
The wires that he'll trip over when he's running.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You draw good wires.
Oh.
Does he have a double identity? Is he really a meek accountant in real life?
Who else could he be besides Overkill?
Well, I mean, what if, when he takes off all these clothes, is he a 97-pound weekly?
Do you see him taking rough fist,
okay,
his thumb? He would have three different cannons that are facing you for the large kapui. So right here, they could be like missile launchers or whatever. But he's going to have those right over here.
What makes you make those value judgments? Why only three? He's got four knuckles.
Because the reader's crazy.
Why does he have more on that side than that side?
No.
For the sake of our unseen viewers, is this really the type of thought process that you guys go through when you create characters?
Except for we have more than 20 minutes.
This is probably longer than you usually do.
Well, I think pause this for a second. So I love Rob Liefeld's comments. Like, you know those cannons that are like triple cannons?
It is like a child... When I was a kid and had like the long paper that you could draw, I remember drawing a battleship once. I'm like, no, 18 cannons, and then a cannon on top of that one.
It's a very like childish and then kind of character structure. Like, and then he's got cannons, and then he's got wires, and then he's got shoulder pads, and then you can't see his feet.
Which isn't easy for me to do, but I think it's very impressive that in a matter of 20 minutes, you guys could come up with something like this. I mean, bad as it is, it's still impressive that you were able to do it this quickly.
Yeah, that's a cool logo.
Rob,
really
didn't
cool.
you promise that you would draw and we
that
would
is
do
a cool
the talking?
Logo.
And when you grow up a little more, you know, we'll let you in there with the grown-ups.
Yeah. Well, when you were creating characters, Stan, what was the process back then? I mean, because Rob and I right now, we do our own writing and our own drawing. We don't collaborate with anybody anymore. Jeez. So
that's the problem, and I've been meaning to talk to you guys about that. Boy, he is one grim-looking guy.
He's one step ahead of
There's no way this man can move. He's got to have a power to defy gravity, I would say, just looking at
He's
him.
He's a tank. I mean, what do you think?
Now, the funniest thing would be if you say that these are jets and he's the fastest man alive.
That and the way you have him.
We've got to justify all of this paraphernalia somehow.
Okay.
I don't know that you're really doing my character right. That's all right, I guess, for a bunch of beginners.
Overkill,
I just want you to... We have a minute and a half, so I want to tighten those feet.
Okay.
All right, guys?
Give him an ankle bone here, an ankle bone here.
I think it takes you longer to sign your name
Heck
than draw a picture.
Oh, man.
I'm going to step out, okay?
Incidentally, you guys have ruined us. We've decided to give up comics and we're going into showbiz.
Oh, my God. So, like, history...
When is Mark Maron going to play Stan Lee? He looks
perfect.
Fucking exactly like him on Glow.
Especially in Glow. So, Henry, so Rob Liefeld, what did he do before Image Comics?
Todd played ball better and clearly was a better... Yeah. He's also a better businessman.
Yeah.
Rob Liefeld was a coked-up child.
Sorry to interrupt, but...
He made his bones on, like, Hulk and stuff, and then he went into... Then he became, like, the preeminent Spider-Man artist in the world.
Well, and Todd was the leader, and at this point, he'd proven himself to be a bit of a businessman and more handleable. So
he's the guy that put it all together. He's the guy that's like, let's fucking walk across the street.
But so Todd at this point, he had either just run Spider-Man, but they didn't give him Amazing. He did Spider-Man. Well, meanwhile,
just called Spider-Man. Was
Rob Liefeld did Youngblood, and they before that X-Force, and they were the biggest thing. They sold 1 million copies of comics, which in the 60s was nothing to stand. He sold 1 million every week, but in the 90s, quite a big deal.
These days, impossible.
Never would happen.
You don't sell like they sell in the. If you get into like the tens of thousands,
you made your book.
You get 100,000, you're the number one comic and a strong number one. Meanwhile, Stan is having to host this comic book TV show that's not doing particularly well. And here he is on these hotshot new guys. And what I love about this is that we always see Grandpa Stan, who's real nice. But when Stan Lee was editor in chief of Marvel for 20 years, he was not a nice guy.
He was a bitter man.
He was a bitter man who gave harsh notes and said to Jack fucking Kirby, draw this better, redo this.
I mean, it's a chilling moment in this video. It's like, you know what, Rob, shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
Rob
did need to shut the fuck
up. Yeah,
yeah. He's a child.
I think a lot of people, particularly younger people who only know Stan Lee as like the old grandpa who shows up in Marvel movies and is now getting elder abused. When Fantastic Four number one came out, he was in his 40s and had been in comic books for his entire professional career and fucking hated it. Like, he didn't show up and make Marvel as a fresh-faced young guy. He was fucking writing the prose backup stories to Captain America and then went on to write shitty romance comics for 20 years.
Yeah, that's right.
And what I also like there is Stan is doing what he did, even in a good way, but he's being very harsh about it, of just saying, like, think about who this person is. Mm-hmm. How do you tell these stories about this person? You just drawing a cool drawing. Who is he?
I mean, a lot of his comments are trolling, I feel, but they're leading these people in the right direction. Like, think more about it. Don't think this is a cool thing I'm doing. Think about who this character is, why they would use these things, what the reality of this person. Mm-hmm. And like, I feel like he's trying to, he's kind of being it's like tough love in a way.
Yeah.
Where he's like, these are the guys who are going to replace me. They need to fucking get their act together.
And I think Stan was being harsh too, because these guys weren't hearing this from their editors. I think he was saying to himself, either these guys are just not being edited at all, or their editors are scared of them because they're superstars. These guys have to hear this stuff. And I don't know what Rob's relationship is with Stan, but I do know that Todd, when people a few months ago started saying, like, is Stanley okay? Todd was one of the first people to chime in of like, well, I hung out with him 2 weeks ago. He seemed okay. We're still buddies.
Did Todd McFarlane say that, or Rob Liefeld?
That was Todd.
Todd McFarlane,
I saw it because Rob Liefeld was like, move into my house. And Kevin Smith was like, move into my house. Yeah. Everyone was like, hey, Stan Lee.
We all want to live in Stan Lee.
That clip is the perfect example of, so for like, for a long time, particularly when I was a kid, the narrative about Stan Lee became, oh, he's a shyster. He only stole things. He was only mean to people. Now, we're not allowed to say anything bad about Stan Lee or Marvel or Star Wars or Disney. But he, for a long time, people were like not cool with Stan Lee.
Yeah.
And this is the perfect example of like, no, like he's an asshole and he did horrible things, but like there's a reason he had his job and why the comics he produced were so popular. Like, he knew what the fuck he was talking about.
This shows you Stan's skills as an editor and a shaper of ideas to make his type of comics. There's many ways to make comic books, but Stan knew how to efficiently and smartly make his type of comics. He's a real idea man who, it is character first for him. And so when he sees guys who are just good at drawing pinups and can't even tell a story.
Yeah, basically.
Rob Liefeld especially is a horrendous comic storyteller.
They both are. I'm reading the...
Yeah, actually, Todd sucks too.
I'm reading the Peter David Hulk right now, which is one of the first major books Todd McFarlane worked on. And the art is just plain right out bad. The inking is terrible, and the panel storytelling, sometimes I'm like, what the fuck is going on? Like, I can only get it because Peter David's words make sense.
I think one of them said kids love lines. That's all I think of when I think of this era of comic art, and my brain was like that too. Like, oh, more lines means more good. Like, this is better art because someone drew more things on this page.
One of the rules of cartooning is lines on face age.
Yeah.
That's what it is. The more lines a character has in their face, the more age they have, and all the characters look like they're 1,000 years old.
So it's note to him of just like, you know, Stan, we write our own stuff, and I've been meaning to talk to you.
Yeah.
That's also, Stan is like an old vaudeville comic who's been doing the same routine for 1,000,000 years, so he's just so fast on his feet.
It feels like they're going to get in trouble after the show. Like, oh no, they're in for it. But yes, that has nothing
he
to
had
do
no
with
no power at the time.
Yeah. I mean, this has nothing to do with video games, but I felt like we talked about that clip on that episode, and I feel like everyone should hear it just to hear a different side of Stan Lee. And hopefully, Stan is doing better these days. Who knows what his fate will be with his horrible family members who are abusing him and his key.
He was held at gunpoint in his front yard, 2 months ago?
I think that was what happened.
It's
hard to keep track of all of them.
Yeah. Stuff has happened since then. That was the most recent thing.
So yeah, the video is called Stanley Owns by H. Bomber Guy, but it's also a supplement to his very good review of the very terrible Killing Joke movie that H. Bomber Guy did.
I saw that in the theater. That movie
is dog shit.
It's so fucking bad and so...
Brian Azzarello, it made me lose all faith in Brian Azzarello. Like, oh, you suck.
It's not even good looking. Those movies, all of those movies they make, those direct-to-video DC movies, are fucking hideous.
Yeah, they're on a poor budget faking the good animation they had 25 years ago.
But you can hear more about cartoons on our cartoon podcast. What a cartoon!
They make me mad.
Which is free, by the way. But thanks for listening, folks. This is a Patreon-supported podcast, in case you didn't know. So if you go to patreon.com/retronauts, you can check out what we have to offer you there. Basically, I'll tell you, if you give $3 a month, what you get is every episode of the show a week ahead of time and ad-free. And that's a great deal if you don't want to hear me talk about underwear Or let's see, basically I do a lot of underwear ads these days. Those are fun, but people don't want to associate my voice with their underwear, and I understand that. So if that's you, then you know what to do. So $3 a month, I think it comes out to like less than 50 cents per podcast, and I feel like that's, wow, that's a good deal. You get conversations like these, trapped in time forever.
I'm a subscriber. Why aren't you?
Exactly. So yes, that's all for my plugs. I'll tell you about where I'm located later, where you can find me. But Matthew, how about you? You're a special guest.
Hey,
people have heard you before.
I can't believe your mom lets you have two podcasts. I've only got the one, or
I've
two
got
Patreons.
Like five podcasts.
I meant Patreons. I've only got the one Patreon at patreon.com/cartoons101, which supports my YouTube show, youtube.com/cartoons101. If you give to that Patreon, you also get a bonus podcast, which recently went through every episode of Neon Genesis Evangelion. Many of those episodes featured you guys.
Oh, yeah.
But I also featured guests like Dawn from the Anime Nostalgia podcast, Tristan Cooper from Dorkly, JDB from Struggle Sesh, a lot of cool guests. And now we moved on to Satoshi Kon Versations, the work of Satoshi Kon, including an episode for every episode of Paranoia Agent. So we're going through all of those, and that features guests like another Struggle Session guy, Jack Allison. You guys came back. Cat Bailey was on the last two episodes of the Ava podcast. I also recently interviewed Bill Oakley. I interviewed Evan Dorkin. I interviewed Scott Gardner. I've interviewed a bunch of cool people. It's been very exciting to run the show, so please go to patreon.com/cartoons101 and help me make that stuff, and check me out on Twitter at Mr. Matt J and at Disney80s90s.
Awesome, great stuff. Henry.
Well, Bob and me worked together on Talking Simpsons, our weekly podcast, where we go through all Simpsons in chronological order. We're starting up season 8 now. I can't believe we made it this far already. And that is supported at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons, where if you get $5 a month, you not only get access to that ad-free and a week early, I'll say it the opposite,
hey.
spice things up, you also get ad-free and a week early What a Cartoon, where we go through a different cartoon each week, including, say, Batman the Animated Series, as we just mentioned. And you know, you should also go there because we do tons of cool interviews, like that interview with Mike Reese, where we ask him what it was like to work on Alf. Before we get into our Simpsons question, we're like, well, first Alf, let's talk about it.
And all the Alf dirt
and tons of other cool stuff, including at the $10 level, you get access to our monthly premium video. We just put up the deleted scenes for season 7 with me and Bob commenting upon it. And you can follow me on Twitter at HENEREYG.
As for me, you can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. And thanks a lot for listening, folks. We'll see you on Monday with a regular length episode. Goodbye.